She didn't slash your tires, Eden. I knew how this was going to look for Lena. I had to shut them down before their mothers got involved.
Yeah, I did,
Link said, his mouth full of ice cream.
Lena's just bummed she didn't think of it first.
He could never resist the chance to harass the cheer squad. To them, Lena was an old joke that wasn't funny anymore, but nobody could drop. That was the thing about small towns. No one ever changed their opinion of you, even if you changed. As far as they were concerned, even when Lena was a great-grandmother, she would still be the crazy girl who busted out the window in English class. Considering most of our English class would still be living in Gatlin. Not me. Not if things were going to stay like this. It was the first time I had really thought about leaving since Lena came to Gatlin. The box of college brochures under my bed had stayed under my bed until now. As long as I had Lena, I wasn't counting the days until I could get out of Gatlin.
Hell oh, who is that?
Eden's voice was a little too loud. I heard the bell on the door of the Dairy Queen chime as it closed. It was like some kind of Clint Eastwood movie, where the hero steps into the saloon after he's just shot up the whole town. The neck of every girl sitting near us snapped toward the door, greasy blonde ponytails flying.
I don't know, but I'd sure like to find out,
Emily purred, coming up behind Eden.
I've never seen him before, have you?
I could see Savannah filing through the yearbook in her mind.
No way. I'd remember him.
Poor guy. Emily had him in her crosshairs, target locked and loaded. He didn't stand a chance, whoever he was. I turned around to get a look at the guy Earl and Emery would be kicking the crap out of when they realized their girlfriends were drooling over him. He was standing in the doorway in a faded black t-shirt, jeans, and scuffed black army boots. I couldn't see the scuffs from where I was sitting, but I knew they were there, because he was wearing exactly the same thing the last time I saw him, when he ripped out of Macon's funeral. It was the stranger, the incubus who wasn't an incubus, the sunlight incubus. I remembered the silver sparrow in Lena's hand when she was sleeping in my bed. What was he doing here? A black tattoo wound around his arm, sort of tribal-looking, like something I'd seen before. I felt a knife in my gut and touched my scar. It was throbbing. Savannah and Emily walked up to the counter, trying to act like they were going to order something, as if they touched anything here other than Diet Coke.
Who is that?
Link wasn't one for competition, not that he was in the running these days.
I don't know, but he showed up at Macon's funeral.
Link was still staring at him.
Is he one of Lena's weird relatives?
I don't know what he is, but he isn't related to Lena.
Then again, he had come to the funeral to pay his respects to Macon. Still, there was something wrong about him. I'd sensed it since the first time I saw him. I heard the bell chime again as the door closed.
Hey, Angel Face, wait up.
I froze. I would have known that voice anywhere. Link was staring at the door, too. He looked like he'd seen a ghost, or worse. Ridley. Lena's dark caster of a cousin was as dangerous and hot and barely dressed as always, except now it was summer, so she had on even less than usual. She was wearing a skin-tight, lacy black tank and a black skirt so small it was probably made for a 10-year-old. Ridley's legs looked longer than ever, balancing on some kind of high, spiky sandals that could stake a vampire. Now the girls weren't the only ones with their mouths hanging open. Most of the school had been at the winter formal when Ridley brought down the house and still managed to look hotter than any girl there, except one. Ridley leaned back and stretched her arms over her head as if we'd woken her from a long nap. She laced her fingers together, stretching even higher, revealing even more skin and the black tattoo encircling her navel. Her tattoo looked a lot like the one on her friend's arm. Ridley whispered something in his ear.
"Holy crap, she's here."
Link was slowly absorbing it. He hadn't seen Ridley since the night of Lena's birthday, when he had talked Ridley out of killing my dad. But he didn't need to see her to think about her. It was pretty clear he'd been thinking about her a lot, based on every song he'd written since she left.
"She's with that guy? Do you think he's, you know, like her?"
A dark caster. He couldn't say it. "Doubt it. His eyes aren't yellow." But he was something. I just didn't know what.
"They're coming over here."
Link looked down at his freeze and Ridley was on us.
"Well, if it isn't two of my favorite people. Fancy meeting you here. John and I were dying for a drink."
Ridley tossed her blonde and pink strands over her shoulder. She slid into the booth across from us and motioned for the guy to sit down. He didn't.
"John Breed."
He said it like it was one name, looking right at me. His eyes were as green as Lena's used to be. What would a light caster be doing with Ridley? Ridley smiled at him.
"This is Lena's, you know, the one I was telling you about."
She dismissed me with a wave of her purple polished fingers.
"I'm Lena's boyfriend, Ethan."
John looked confused, but only for a second. He was the kind of guy who looked relaxed, as if he knew everything would go his way eventually.
"Lena never told me she had a boyfriend."
Every muscle in my body tightened. He knew Lena, but I didn't know him. He had seen her since the funeral, at least talked to her. When had that happened, and why hadn't she told me?
"How exactly do you know my girlfriend?"
My voice was too loud, and I could feel the eyes on us.
"Relax, short straw, we were in the neighborhood."
Ridley looked across at Link.
"How you been, Hot Rod?"
Link cleared his throat awkwardly.
"Good."
His voice came out kind of squeaky.
"I've been real good. Thought you left town."
Ridley didn't answer. I was still looking at John, and he was staring right back, sizing me up, probably figuring out 1,000 ways to get rid of me. Because he was after something, or someone, and I was in his way. Ridley wouldn't just show up here with this guy now, not after 4 months. I kept my eyes on him.
"Ridley, you shouldn't be here."
"Don't get your panties in a twist, boyfriend. We're just passing through, on our way back from Ravenwood."
She said it casually, like it wasn't a big deal. I laughed.
"Ravenwood? They wouldn't let you in the door. Lena would burn the house down first."
Ridley and Lena had grown up together, like sisters, until Ridley went dark. Ridley had helped Seraphine find Lena on her birthday, which almost got us all, including my father, killed. There was no way Lena would hang out with her. She smiled.
"Times have changed, Short Straw. I'm not on the best terms with the rest of my family, but Lena and I have worked things out.
Why don't you ask her?"
"You're lying."
Ridley unwrapped a cherry lollipop, which looked innocent enough, but was the ultimate weapon in her hands.
"You clearly have trust issues. I'd love to help you with that, but we've got to get going. Have to fill up John's bike before that hick gas station of yours runs out of gas."
I was holding the side of the table, and my knuckles went white.
His bike.
It was sitting out front, right now, and I bet it was a Harley. the same bike I had seen in the photograph on the wall of Lena's room. John Breed had picked up Lena from Lake Moultrie, and before he said another word, I knew John Breed wasn't about to disappear. He'd be waiting on the corner the next time Lena needed a ride. I stood up. I wasn't sure what I was going to do, but Link was. He slid out of the booth and shoved me toward the door.
Let's get out of here, man.
Ridley called after us.
I really did miss you, Shrinky Dink.
She tried to make it sound sarcastic, like one of her jokes, but the sarcasm stuck in her throat, and it came out sounding more like the truth. I slammed my palm against the door, sending it flying open. But before it swung shut, I heard John's voice.
Nice to meet you, Ethan. Say hi to Lena for me.
My hands were shaking, and I heard Ridley laugh. She didn't have to lie to hurt me today. She had the truth. We didn't talk on the way to Ravenwood. Neither one of us knew what to say. Girls can do that to you, especially Caster girls. When we reached the top of the long drive leading to Ravenwood Manor, the gates were closed, something I'd never seen before. The ivy had grown over the twisting metal, as if it had always been there. I got out of the car and shook the gate to see if it would swing open, knowing it wouldn't. I looked up at the house behind it. The windows were dark, and the sky over the house looked even darker. What had happened? I could have handled Lena's freakout at the lake and feeling like she had to take off, but why him? Why the Caster boy with the Harley? How long had she been hanging out with him without telling me, and what did Ridley have to do with it? I had never been this mad at her before. It was one thing to be attacked by someone you hated, but this was something else. This was the kind of hurt that could only be inflicted by someone you loved, who you thought loved you. It was sort of like being stabbed from the inside out.
You okay, man?
Link slammed the driver's side door. No. I looked down the long driveway ahead of us.
Me neither.
Link tossed the key through the fastback's open window, and we headed down the hill. We hitched back to town, Link turning every few minutes to check the stretch of road behind us for a Harley, but I didn't think we'd see it. That particular Harley wouldn't be headed into town. For all I knew, it could be inside those gates already. I didn't come down for dinner, which was my first mistake. My second was opening the black Converse shoebox. I shook it open, the contents spilling across my bed. A note Lena had written me on the back of a wrinkled Snickers wrapper, a ticket stub from the movie we saw on our first date, a faded receipt from the Dairy Queen, and a highlighted page ripped out of a book that had reminded me of her. It was the box where I stashed all our memories, my version of Lena's necklace. It didn't seem like the kind of thing a guy should do, so I didn't let on that I did it, not even to her. I picked up the crumpled photo from the winter formal, taken the second before we were doused with liquid snow by my so-called friends. The picture was blurry, but we were captured in a kiss. So happy it was hard to look at now. Remembering that night, even though I knew the next moment was going to be awful, it felt like part of me was still back there kissing her.
Ethan, wait, is that you?
I tried to shove everything back into the box when I heard my door opening, and the box fell, scattering everything onto the floor.
You feeling all right?
Amma came into my room and sat at the foot of my bed. She hadn't done that since I'd had stomach flu in sixth grade. Not that she didn't love me. We just had things worked out in a way that didn't include sitting on beds.
I'm tired, that's all.
She looked at the mess on the floor.
You look lower than a catfish at the bottom of the river.
and a perfectly good pork chop's looking as sorry as you are down in my kitchen. That's two kinds of sorry." She leaned forward and brushed my hair out of my eyes. She was always after me to cut my hair. "I know, I know. The eyes are the window to the soul, and I need a haircut." "You need a good sight more than a haircut." She looked sad and grabbed my chin as if she could lift me up by it. Given the right circumstances, I bet she could. "You're not right." "I'm not?" "You're not, and you're my boy, and it's my fault." "What do you mean?" I didn't understand, and she didn't elaborate, which was generally how our conversations went. "She's not right either, you know." Amma spoke softly, looking out my window. "Not being right isn't always somebody's fault. Sometimes it's just a fact, like the cards you pull." With Amma, everything came down to fate, the cards in her tarot deck, the bones in the graveyard, the universe she could read. "Yes, ma'am." She looked into my eyes, and I could see hers shining. "Sometimes things aren't what they seem, and even a seer can't tell what's coming." She took my hand and dropped something into it. A red string with tiny beads knotted into it, one of her charms. "Tie it round your wrist." "Amma, guys don't wear bracelets." "Since when do I make jewelry? That's for women with too much time and not enough sense." She yanked on her apron, straightening it. "A red string's a tie to the other world, offers the kind of protection I can't." "Go on. Put it on." I knew better than to argue when Amma had that look on her face. It was a mixture of fear and sadness, and she wore it like a burden too heavy for her to carry. I held out my arm and let her tie the string around my wrist. Before I could say anything else, she was at my window, pouring a handful of salt from her apron pocket all along the sill. "Everything's gonna be okay, Amma. Don't worry." Amma stopped in the doorway and looked back at me, rubbing the shine out of her eyes. "Been chopping onions all afternoon." Something wasn't right, like Amma said, but I had a feeling it wasn't me. "You know anything about a guy named John Breed?" She stiffened. "Ethan, wait. Don't you make me give that pork chop to Lucille." "No, ma'am." Amma knew something, and it wasn't good. And she wasn't talking. I knew it as sure as I knew her pork chop recipe, which didn't have a single onion in it. June 14th. Bookworm. If it was good enough for Melville Dewey, it's good enough for me. Marion winked at me as she pulled a stack of new books out of a cardboard box, sniffing deeply. There were books everywhere, in a circle around her almost up to her head. Lucille was weaving through the towers of books, prowling for a lost cicada. Marion had made an exception to the Gatlin County Library's no pets rule, since the place was full of books, but empty of people. Only an idiot would be in the library on the first day of summer, or someone who needed a distraction. Someone who wasn't speaking to his girlfriend, or wasn't being spoken to by his girlfriend, or didn't know if he even still had one, all in the space of the two longest days of his life. I still hadn't talked to Lena. I told myself it was because I was too angry, but that was one of those lies you tell when you're trying to convince yourself that you're doing the right thing. The truth was, I didn't know what to say. I didn't want to ask the questions, and I was scared to hear the answers. Besides, I wasn't the one who ran off with some guy on a motorcycle. "It's chaos. Dewey Decimal is mocking you. I can't even find one almanac on the history of the moon's orbital pattern." The voice from the stacks startled me.
Now, Olivia. Marion smiled to herself as she examined the bindings of the books in her hands. It was hard to believe she was old enough to be my mother, with not a streak of gray in her short hair and not a wrinkle in her golden brown skin. She didn't look more than 30. Professor Ashcroft, this isn't 1876. Times do change. It was a girl's voice. She had an accent, British, I think. I had only heard people talk that way in James Bond movies. So has the Dewey Decimal System, 22 times to be exact. Marion shelved a stray book. What about the Library of Congress? The voice sounded exasperated. Give me 100 more years. The Universal Decimal Classification? Now irritated. This is South Carolina, not Belgium. Perhaps the Harvard Yenching System. Nobody in this county speaks Chinese, Olivia. A blonde, lanky girl poked her head out from behind the stacks. Not true, Professor Ashcroft. At least, not for the summer holidays. You speak Chinese? I couldn't help myself. When Marion had mentioned her summer research assistant, she hadn't told me the girl would be a teenage version of herself, except for the streaky, honey-colored hair, the pale skin, and the accent. They could have been mother and daughter. Even at first glance, the girl had a vague degree of Marion-ness that was hard to describe and that you wouldn't find in anyone else in town. The girl looked at me. You don't? She poked me in the ribs. That was a joke. In my opinion, people in this country barely speak English. She smiled and held out her hand. She was tall, but I was taller, and she looked up at me as if she was already confident we were great friends. Olivia Durand, live to my friends. You must be Ethan Waite. Which I find hard to believe, actually. The way Professor Ashcroft talks about you, I was expecting more of a swashbuckler with a bayonet. Marion laughed, and I turned red. What has she been telling you? Only that you're incredibly brilliant and brave and virtuous, quite the save-the-day sort. Every bit the son you would expect of the beloved Lila Evers Waite. And that you'll be my lowly assistant this summer, so I can boss you around all I like. She smiled at me, and I blanked. She was nothing like Lena, but nothing like the girls in Gatlin either, which was in itself more than confusing. Everything she was wearing had a weathered look, from her faded jeans and the random bits of string and beads around her wrists, to her holy silver high tops, held together with duct tape, and her ratty Pink Floyd t-shirt. She had a big black plastic watch with crazy-looking dials on the face, caught between the bits of string. I was too embarrassed to say anything. Marion swooped in to rescue me. Don't mind Liv. She's teasing. Even the gods love jokes, Ethan. Plato, and stop showing off, Liv laughed. I will. Marion smiled, impressed. He's not laughing. Liv pointed at me, suddenly serious. Hollow laughter in marble halls. Shakespeare? I looked at her. Liv winked and yanked on her t-shirt. Pink Floyd, I can see you've got a lot to learn. A teenage Marion and not at all what I had expected when I signed on for a summer job in the library. Now, children. Marion held out her hand, and I pulled her up from the floor. Even on a hot day like today, she still managed to look cool. Not a hair was out of place. Her patterned blouse rustled as she walked in front of me. I'll leave the stacks to you, Olivia. I have a special project for Ethan in the archive. Right, of course. The highly trained history student sorts out the stacks while the unschooled slacker is promoted to the archive. How very American. She rolled her eyes and picked up a box of books. The archive hadn't changed since last month, when I came to ask Marion about a summer job, but stayed to talk about Lena and my dad and Macon. She had been sympathetic, the way she always was. There were piles of old Civil War registries on the shelf above my mother's desk, and her collection of antique glass paperweights. A glistening black sphere sat next to the misshapen clay apple I made for her in first grade. My mom's and Marion's books and notes were still stacked across the desk over yellowed maps of Ravenwood and Greenbrier spread open on the tables. Every scribbled scrap of paper I saw made it seem like she was here. Even though everything in my life seemed to be going wrong, I always felt better in this place. It was like I was with my mom, and she was the one person who always knew how to fix things, or at least make me believe there was a way to fix them. But something else was on my mind.
"That's your summer intern?"
"Of course."
"You didn't tell me she'd be like that."
"Like what, Ethan?"
"Like you."
"Is that what's bothering you? The brains, or is it perhaps the long blonde hair? Is there a certain way a librarian should look? Big glasses and hair in graying bun? I would have thought between your mother and me, we would have disabused you of at least that notion." She was right. My mom and Marion had always been two of the most beautiful women in Gatlin. "Liv won't be here very long, and she's not much older than you are. I was thinking the least you could do would be to show her around town, introduce her to some people your age."
"Like who, Link? To improve his vocabulary and kill off a few thousand of her brain cells?"
I didn't mention that Link would spend most of his time trying to hook up with her, which I didn't see happening. "I was thinking of Lena." The silence in the room was embarrassing, even to me. Of course she had been thinking of Lena. The question was, why hadn't I? Marion looked at me evenly. "Why don't you tell me what's really on your mind today?"
"What is it you need me to do in here, Aunt Marion?"
I didn't feel like talking about it. She sighed and turned back to the archive. "I thought maybe you could help me sort through some of this. Obviously, a great deal of the material in here relates to the locket and Ethan and Genevieve. Now that we know the end of that story, we might want to make some room for the next one."
"What's the next one?"
I picked up the old photo of Genevieve wearing the locket. I remembered the first time I had looked at it with Lena. It felt like years since then, instead of months. "It would seem to me that it's yours and Lena's. The events on her birthday raised a number of questions, most of which I can't answer. I've never heard of an incident when a caster didn't have to choose light or dark on the night of their claiming, except in the case of Lena's family, when the choice is made for them. Now that we don't have Macon to help us, I'm afraid we're going to have to search out the answers ourselves." Lucille jumped up onto my mother's chair, her ears perking up.
"I wouldn't know where to start."
"He who chooses the beginning of the road chooses the place it leads to."
"Thoreau?"
"Harry Emerson Fosdick. A bit older and more obscure, but still quite relevant, I think." She smiled and put her hand on the edge of the door.
"Aren't you going to help me?"
"I can't leave Olivia alone for long, or she'll reshelve the entire collection, and then we'll all have to learn Chinese." She paused for a moment, watching me, looking so much like my mom. "I think you can handle this one on your own, at least the beginning."
"I don't have a choice, do I? You can't really help me since you're a keeper."
I was still bitter about Marion's revelation that she had known my mother was involved with the caster world, but would never explain why or how. There were so many things about my mother and her death that Marion had never told me. It always came back to the endless rules that bound Marion to her job as a keeper. I can only help you help yourself. I can't determine the course of events, the unraveling of darkness and light, the order of things. That's such a load of crap. What? It's like the prime directive on Star Trek. You have to let the planet evolve at its own pace. You can't introduce hyperspace or warp speed until they discover it for themselves. But Captain Kirk and the crew of the Enterprise always end up breaking the rule. Unlike Captain Kirk, there is no choice in my case. A keeper is powerfully bound to act neither for the dark nor the light. I couldn't change my destiny, even if I wanted to. I have my own place in the natural order of the Castor world, in the order of things. Whatever. It's not a choice. I don't have the authority to change the way things work. If I so much as tried, I might destroy not only myself, but the very people I was trying to help. But my mom still ended up dead. I don't know why I said it, but I couldn't understand the logic. Marion had to remain uninvolved to protect the people she cared about, but the person she cared about most died anyway. Are you asking me if I could have prevented your mother's death? She knew I was. I looked down at my sneakers. I wasn't sure I was ready to hear the answer. Marion put her hand under my chin and pulled my face up to meet hers. I didn't know your mother was in danger, Ethan. But she knew the risks. Her voice was uneven, and I knew I had gone too far, but I couldn't help it. I'd been trying to get up the courage to have this conversation for months now. I would have gladly taken her place in that car. Don't you think I have wondered 1,000 times if there was something I knew or could have done that might have saved Lila? Her voice trailed off. I feel the same way. You're just holding on to a different edge of the same jagged hole. We're both lost. That's what I wanted to say. Instead, I let her put her arm around my shoulder and pull me into a rough hug. I barely felt it when the arm slipped away and the door closed behind her. I stared at the stacks of paper. Lucille jumped down from the chair and onto the table.
Be careful. These are a lot older than you.
She tilted her head and looked at me with her blue eyes. Then she froze. She was staring at my mother's chair, eyes wide, fixated. There was nothing there, but I remembered what Amma had told me.
Cats can see the dead. That's why they stare at things the way they do for so long, like they're just looking into thin air. But they're not. They're looking through it.
I stepped closer to the chair. Mom? She didn't answer. Or maybe she did, because there was a book lying on the chair that wasn't there a minute ago. Darkness and Light, The Origins of Magic. It was one of Macon's books. I had seen it in his library at Ravenwood. I lifted it up and a gum wrapper fell out. One of my mother's bookmarks, no doubt. I bent down to pick up the wrapper and the room began to sway, the lights and colors swirling around me. I tried to focus on something, anything, to keep from falling, but I was too dizzy. The wood floor rushed up to meet me, and as I hit the ground, the smoke burned my eyes.
By the time Abraham returned to Ravenwood, the ash had already made its way inside the house. The charred remnants of Gatlin's great houses wafted down from the open windows on the second floor like black snowflakes. As he ascended the staircase, Abraham's footsteps left impressions in the thin black layer already coating the floor. He secured the upstairs windows without putting the Book of Moons down for a second. But he couldn't have put it down, even if he had wanted to. Ivy, the old cook from Greenbrier, was right. The book was calling him, a whisper only he could hear. When he reached the study, Abraham rested the book on the polished mahogany desk. He knew exactly which page to turn to, as if the book was flipping the pages itself, as if it knew what he wanted. Even though he had never seen the book before, Abraham knew the answer was in those pages, an answer that would guarantee Ravenwood's survival. The book was offering him the one thing he wanted above all else, but it wanted something in return. Abraham stared down at the Latin script. He recognized it immediately. It was a cast he had read about in other books, one he had always considered more of a myth, but he had been wrong, because it was staring back at him. Abraham heard Jonah's voice before he saw him. "Abraham, we have to get out of the house. The Federals are coming. They've burned everything, and they aren't planning to stop until they reach Savannah. We have to get into the tunnels." Abraham's voice was resolute, and it sounded different somehow, even to him. "I'm not going anywhere, Jonah." "What are you talking about? We have to save what we can and get out of here." Jonah grabbed his brother's arm, noticing the open page beneath them. He stared at the script, unsure he could trust what he was seeing. "The Demonis Pactum? The demon's trade?" Jonah stepped back. "Is this what I think it is? The Book of Moons? I'm surprised you recognize it. You never paid much attention during our studies." Jonah was used to Abraham's insults, but there was something different about his tone tonight. "Abraham, you can't. Don't tell me what I can't do. You would watch this house burn to the ground before you thought to act. You have never been capable of doing what was required. You are weak, like mother." Jonah flinched, as if someone had struck him. "Where did you get it?" "You don't need to worry about that." "Abraham, be sensible. The demon's trade is too powerful. It cannot be controlled. You are making a bargain without knowing what you will have to sacrifice. We have other houses." Abraham pushed his brother aside. Though Abraham barely touched him, Jonah flew across the room. "Other houses? Ravenwood is the seat of our family's power in the mortal world, and you think I intend to allow a few soldiers to burn it to the ground? I can use this to save Ravenwood." Abraham's voice rose. "Exinde neca, odium incende, mors portam patafecit. Destroy, kill, hate, death opens the gate. Abraham, stop!" But it was too late. The words rolled off Abraham's tongue as if he had known them his entire life. Jonah looked around, panicked, waiting for the cast to take effect. But he had no idea what his brother had asked for. He only knew that whatever it was, it would be done. That was the power of the cast. But there was also a price. It was never the same. Jonah rushed toward his brother, and a small, perfectly round orb, the size of an egg, slipped from his pocket and rolled across the floor. Abraham picked up the sphere, glowing at his feet, and rolled it between his fingers. "What are you doing with an arc light, Jonah? Is there a particular incubus you're planning to imprison in this archaic device?" Jonah backed away as Abraham advanced, matching him step for step. But Abraham was too fast. In the blink of an eye, he pinned Jonah against the wall, his iron grip closing around his brother's throat. "No, of course not. Abraham tightened his hold. "What would an incubus be doing with the only vessel capable of imprisoning his kind? Do you think I'm that stupid?" "I am only trying to protect you from yourself." In one fluid motion, Abraham lunged forward and plunged his teeth into his brother's shoulder. Then he did the unthinkable. He drank. The bargain was made. He would no longer be sustained by the memories and dreams of mortals. From this day forward, he would crave blood. When he had his fill, Abraham dropped his brother's limp body and licked the ash from his hand, the taste of flesh still lingering in the black residue. You should have been more concerned about protecting yourself. Abraham turned away from his brother's body. Ethan.
Ethan? I opened my eyes. I was lying on the floor of the archive. Marion was hovering over me in an un-Marion state of panic. What happened? I don't know. I sat up, rubbing my head, wincing. There was a knot growing underneath my hair. I must have hit the table on my way down. Macon's book was lying on the floor, open next to me. Marion looked at me with her uncanny ESP, or not so uncanny if you stopped to consider that she had followed me into visions herself only months ago. Within seconds, she had a cold pack in her hand and was holding it against my throbbing head. You're having visions again, aren't you? I nodded. My mind was swimming with images, but I couldn't focus on any one of them. It's the second time. I had one the other night when I was holding Macon's journal. What did you see? It was the night of the fires, like in the Locket visions. Ethan Carter Waite was already dead. Ivy had the Book of Moons, and she gave it to Abraham Ravenwood. He was in both of the visions. His name sounded thick and fuzzy on my tongue. Abraham Ravenwood was the original boogeyman of Gatlin County. I gripped the edge of the table, steadying myself. Who wanted me to see the visions? More important, why? Marion paused, still holding the book. Oh? She looked at me carefully. And someone else. His name began with a J. Judas, Joseph, Jonah, that was it. I think they were brothers. They were incubuses. Not just incubuses. Marion snapped the book shut. Abraham Ravenwood was a powerful blood incubus, the father of the Ravenwood blood incubus line. What do you mean? So, the story folks had been telling for years was true? I had cleared another layer of fog from the supernatural map of Gatlin. Although all incubuses are dark by nature, not all of them choose to feed on blood. But once one does, the instinct appears to be inherited. I leaned against the table as the vision sharpened in my mind. Abraham. He's the reason Ravenwood Manor never burned, right? He didn't make a deal with the devil. He made it with the Book of Moons. Abraham was dangerous, maybe more dangerous than any caster. I can't imagine why you're seeing him now. Fortunately, he died young, before Macon was born. I tried to do the math. That's young? How long do incubuses usually live? 150 to 200 years. She replaced the book on her work table. I don't know what any of this has to do with you or Macon's journal, but I never should have given it to you. I interfered. We should leave this book locked up here. Aunt Marion, Ethan, don't pursue this, and don't tell anyone else about it, not even Amma. I can't imagine how she would react if you said the name Abraham Ravenwood in her presence. She put her arm around me and gave me a half-hearted squeeze. Now, let's go finish up in the stacks before Olivia calls the police. She turned to the door and stuck her key in the lock. There was one more thing. I had to say it. He could see me, Aunt Marion. Abraham looked right at me and said my name. That's never happened in the visions before. Marion stopped, staring at the door as if she could see right through it. It was more than a few seconds before she turned the key in the lock and swung the door open.
"Olivia, do you think Melville Dewey could spare you for a cup of tea?"
Our conversation was over. Marion was a keeper and the head librarian of the Castor Library, the Lunae Libri. She could only tell me so much without violating her obligations. She couldn't take sides or change the course of events once they were set in motion. She couldn't be Macon for me, and she wasn't my mom. I was on my own. June 14th. Beneath the paper. All of those? There were three stacks of brown papered packages on the checkout desk. Marion marked the last one with the familiar Gatlin County Library stamp, always twice and always tied with the same white string. "No, take that pile too." She pointed to a second pile on the nearest trolley.
"I thought nobody in this town reads."
"Oh, they read. They just don't own up to what they read, which is why we make not only library-to-library deliveries, but library-to-home ones as well. Circulating books only, allowing 2 to 3 days for the processing of requests, of course." "Great." I was afraid to ask what was in these brown paper packages, and I was pretty sure I didn't want to know. I picked up a stack of books and groaned.
"What are these, encyclopedias?"
Liv pulled the receipt from the top bundle.
"Yes, the Encyclopedia of Ammunition, actually."
Marion waved us out the door. "Go with Ethan, Liv. You haven't had an opportunity to see our beautiful little town yet."
"I can handle it."
Liv sighed and pushed the trolley toward the door.
"Come on, Hercules. I'll help you load up. Can't keep the ladies of Gatlin waiting on their..."
She consulted another receipt.
"Carolina Cake Doctor Cookbook. Now can we?"
"Carolina," I said automatically.
"That's what I said. Carolina."
2 hours later, we had delivered most of the books and driven by both Jackson High and the Stop and Steal. As we circled the General's Green, I realized why Marion had been so eager to hire me at a library that was always empty and didn't need summer employees. She had planned for me to be Liv's teenage tour guide all along. It was my job to show her the lake and the Dairy Queen and fill in the gaps between what folks around here said and what they meant. My job was to be her friend. I wondered how Lena was going to feel about that, if she noticed.
"I still don't understand why there's a statue of a general from a war the South didn't win, and one which was generally embarrassing for your country in the middle of town."
"Of course she didn't.
Folks honor the fallen around here. There's a whole museum dedicated to them."
I didn't mention the fallen soldiers was also the scene of my dad's Ridley-induced suicide attempt a few months ago. I looked over at Liv from behind the wheel of the Volvo. I couldn't remember the last time there had been any girl except Lena in the passenger seat.
"You're a terrible tour guide."
"This is Gatlin. There isn't all that much to see."
I glanced in the rearview mirror. "Or just... not that much I want you to see."
"What do you mean by that?"
"A good tour guide knows what to show and what to hide."
"I stand corrected. You're a terribly misguided tour guide."
She pulled a rubber band out of her pocket.
"So I'm more of a misguide?"
It was a stupid joke. My trademark.
"And I take issue with both your punning and your tour-guiding philosophy, generally speaking."
She was working her blonde hair into 2 braids, her cheeks pink from the heat. She wasn't used to the South Carolina humidity.
"What do you want to see? You want me to take you to shoot cans behind the old cotton mill off Route 9? Flatten pennies on the train tracks?
follow the trail of flies into the eat-at-your-own-risk grease pit we call the Dairy Keen?
Yes, all of the above, particularly the last bit. I'm starving.
Liv dropped the last library receipt into one of two piles. 7, 8, 9, which means I win, you lose. And get your hands off those chips. They belong to me now. She pulled my chili fries over to her side of the red plastic table.
You mean fries. I mean business.
Her side of the table was already covered with onion rings, a cheeseburger, ketchup, mayonnaise, and my sweet tea. I knew whose side was whose because she had made a line between us, laying French fries end to end, like the Great Wall of China.
Good fences make good neighbors.
I remembered the poem from English class.
Walt Whitman.
She shook her head.
Robert Frost. Now keep your hands off my onion rings.
I should have known that one. How many times had Lena quoted Frost's poems or twisted them into one of her own? We had stopped for lunch at the Dairy Keen, which was down the road from the last two deliveries we'd made, Mrs. Ipswich, Guide to Colon Cleanliness, and Mr. Harlow, Classic Pinups of World War II, which we had given to his wife because he wasn't home. For the first time, I understood the reason for the brown paper.
I can't believe it. I wadded up my napkin. Who would have figured Gatlin was so romantic?
I had bet on church books. Liv had bet on romance novels. I lost 8-9.
Not only romantic, but romantic and righteous. It's a wonderful combination.
So hypocritical?
Not at all. I was going to say American. Did you notice we delivered It Takes a Bible and Divinely Delicious Delilah to the very same house?
I thought that was a cookbook.
Not unless Delilah's cooking up something quite a bit hotter than these chili chips.
She waved a fry in the air.
Fries.
Exactly.
I turned bright red, thinking about how flustered Mrs. Lincoln had looked when we dropped those books off at her door. I didn't point out to Liv that Delilah's devotee was the mother of my best friend and the most ruthlessly righteous woman in town.
So, you like the Dairy Keen?
I changed the subject.
I'm mad about it.
Liv took a bite of her cheeseburger, big enough to put Link to shame. I'd already seen her wolf down more than the average varsity basketball player at lunch. She didn't seem to care what I thought about her one way or another, which was a relief, especially since everything I did around Lena lately was wrong.
So, what would we find in your brown paper package? Church books, romance novels, or both?
I don't know.
I had more secrets than I knew what to do with, but I wasn't about to share any of them.
Come on, everyone has secrets.
Not everyone, I lied.
There's nothing at all beneath your paper.
Nope, just more paper, I guess.
In a way, I wished it was true.
So you're rather like an onion.
More like a regular old potato.
She picked up a fry and examined it.
Ethan Waite is no regular old potato. You, sir, are a French fry.
She popped it into her mouth, smiling. I laughed and conceded.
Fine, I'm a French fry, but no brown paper, nothing to tell.
Liv stirred her sweet tea with her straw.
That confirms it. You are definitely on the waiting list for Divinely Delicious Delilah.
You caught me.
I can't promise anything, but I will tell you that I know the librarian rather well, it turns out.
So you'll hook me up?
I will hook you up, dude.
Liv started laughing, and I did too. She was easy to be around, like I'd known her forever. I was having fun, which by the time we stopped laughing, turned into feeling guilty. Explain that to me. She returned to her fries.
I find all the secrecy sort of romantic, don't you? I didn't know how to answer that, considering how deep the secrets went around here. In my town, the pub is on the same street as the church, and the congregation moves directly from one to the other. Sometimes we even eat Sunday dinner there. I smiled.
Is it divinely delicious?
Nearly. Maybe not quite so hot. But the drinks are not quite so cold. She pointed at her sweet tea with a fry. Ice, my friend, is something you find on the ground more often than in your glass.
You have a problem with Gatlin County's famous sweet tea?
Tea is meant to be hot, sir, from a kettle. I stole a fry and pointed it back at her sweet tea.
Well, ma'am, to a strict Southern Baptist, that is the devil's drink.
You mean because it's cold?
I mean because it's tea. No caffeine allowed. Liv looked shocked.
No tea? I'll never understand this country.
I stole another fry. You want to talk about blasphemy? You weren't there when Millie's Breakfast and Biscuits, over on Maine, started serving pre-made freezer biscuits. My great-aunts, the sisters, pitched a fit that nearly took down the place. I mean, chairs were flying.
Are they nuns?
Liv stuck an onion ring inside her cheeseburger.
Who? The sisters.
Another onion ring. No, they're actual sisters.
I see.
She slapped the bun back down. You don't, not really. She picked up the burger and took a bite.
Not at all.
We both started laughing again. I didn't hear Mr. Gentry walk up behind us.
Y'all get enough to eat?
He asked, wiping his hands with a rag. I nodded.
Yes, sir. How's that girlfriend of yours?
He asked as if he was hoping I had come to my senses and dumped Lena by now.
Fine, sir.
He nodded, disappointed, and walked back toward the counter.
Say hello to Miss Alma for me.
I take it he doesn't like your girlfriend?
She said it like a question, but I didn't know what to say. Was a girl still technically your girlfriend if she drove off with another guy?
I think Professor Ashcroft may have mentioned her.
Lena, my... Her name is Lena. I hoped I didn't look as uncomfortable as I felt. Liv didn't seem to notice. She took another sip of her tea.
I'll probably meet her at the library.
I don't know if she'll be coming by the library. Things have been weird lately. I don't know why I said it. I barely knew Liv. But it felt good to say it out loud, and my insides untwisted a little.
I'm sure you'll work it out. Back home, I fought with my boyfriend all the time.
Her voice was light. She was trying to make me feel better. How long have you guys been together? Liv waved her hand in the air, the weird watch sliding down her wrist.
Oh, we broke up. He was a bit of a prat. I don't think he liked having a girlfriend who was smarter than he was.
I wanted to get off the subject of girlfriends and ex-girlfriends. So what's that thing, anyway? I nodded at the watch, or whatever it was.
This?
She held her wrist over the table so I could see the clunky black watch. It had three dials and a little silver needle that rested on a rectangle with zigzags all over it, sort of like one of those machines that track the strength of earthquakes.
It's a selenometer.
I looked at her blankly.
Selene, the Greek goddess of the moon. Metron, or measure in Greek.
She smiled.
A little rusty on your Greek etymology?
A little.
It measures the moon's gravitational pull.
She turned one of the dials thoughtfully. Numbers appeared under the pointer. Why do you care about the moon's gravitational pull?
I'm an amateur astronomer. I'm interested in the moon, mostly. It has a tremendous impact on the Earth. You know, the tides and everything. That's why I made this.
I almost spit out my Coke. You made it? Seriously? Don't be so impressed. It wasn't that difficult.
Liv's cheeks flushed again. I was embarrassing her. She reached for another fry.
These